Alaska's public lands may be more of a resource than we realize. We all say the words last frontier, but guess what? We really are. In a lot of different ways. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today, a filmmaker whose subject is our wildlife. We're talking bears of the last frontier at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org. All over the world, if a place has bears, it's wild. But increasingly, people and bears are learning to put up with one another on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. And by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, if you're watching public television these days, on Sunday nights, they have started running a series of three shows, Bears of the Last Frontier, and we're talking to the filmmaker today on the show. And actually, we tried to get the host, but he's on Letterman tonight, so he's busy doing that. He's already in the Letterman shop being prepped, so we couldn't get Chris Morgan, so we had to settle for the filmmaker, but we may learn more that way. Joe Pontecorvo, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you.
So you and Chris have this outfit called Wildlife Media, and based on that, you have basically for a while now been working on the issues of wildlife and managing to go out and make documentaries about wildlife, right?
That's correct. Yeah, one of our goals of Wildlife Media was to be able to launch to make films that were also part of a campaign, so that we could raise awareness in this case of bear conservation globally. And out of that came this series that was more Alaskan centric, Bears of the Last Frontier. It was sort of inspired by a larger film we're doing about global bear conservation.
I see. So yeah, so you're in the midst of a large project, and yet part of that gave birth to this series of three TV series. They're part of the Nature series on PBS, and these three are set in Alaska, but it's actually part of a larger project then.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, the idea behind Bear Trek is that it's a global motorcycle adventure, and we look at a number of rare species of bears that a lot of people never heard of, sun bears, which is the smallest of the bear species, and they're in Borneo. Spectacle bears, which are like rock climbing bears that live in Peru. And they're all threatened, and their habitats as well. So we were looking at these bears as sort of icons species and indicator species for the habitat. So if we knew the bears were there, then the habitat was healthy, and if we could protect those bears, we could protect the habitat.
Wow.
And that's kind of the concept behind it, yeah.
Yeah. So I want to zero in a little bit on the PBS series and Alaska and that it's three parts and all like that. But first, I got to bring up one glaring absurdity about your project, and that is bears really don't like motorcycles much.
No, that's true. But, and it's funny because when Chris first brought up the idea of a motorcycle adventure around the world, I was a little skeptical. But then he told me this is what he used in the field for research all the time. This is how he got from A to B. And I always thought, okay, you just like motorcycles. And then later on, we go to Borneo, and Wong, our sun bear biologist, has this little dirt bike he's riding around. And that's how he gets from place to place. And the same with Robin Appleton in Peru. So actually, in the end, I was proven wrong that researchers do use motorcycles for bear research.
Right. But you, with all your camera gear, and I guess it wasn't just you, right? You got a whole crew for much of this. If there was a road, you probably would prefer a van. And probably everybody would prefer a van when it came to resupplying themselves, because you can carry all that much on one of those things.
Yeah. I mean, as in Alaska, a lot of how we got from A to B was with bush plane. We would be dropped off at various locations. When we could, we would load up a van in the case of driving up the haul road and get there that way. But a good portion of the time we were actually, you know, flying from A to B.
Do you have a timeline on when you'd like to finish the entire, what did you call it, the Bear project?
The Bear Trek?
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, we're hoping to target 2012 for our completion date. You know, we've got one more location to do, and then we would begin editing. So that's kind of our goal, and it's all, you know, privately funded, so we're just, you know, looking for people to contribute to get it done. And, you know, it's the idea behind this, as well as sort of the series in a way, is to raise awareness about bears, but using them more as an icon to talk about the habitat. And with Bear Trek, that's particularly true because we also have a campaign. So we're visiting specific scientific projects all along the way, and hoping, and part of our budget actually contributes to those scientific projects. So it's more than just a film. It's also sort of a campaign, is a campaign.
I noticed that you guys, when you went to the Alaska Peninsula, concentrated on Katmai as opposed to McNeil, which as a bear viewing gourmand, it's usually thought that the McNeil experience is superior. But I guess if you get in the remoter parts of, the outer coast parts of Katmai, there's, as Timothy Treadwell showed, there's some pretty interesting bear areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those bays are really are real gems. And what we wanted to do is, try to find areas that were not the same areas you typically see time after time. I think McNeil River has been filmed quite a bit. There's remote cameras placed there and so forth. And we also wanted to get out a little bit further and explore other areas. So that was kind of our goal there.
Yeah. So that's the part we've missed already, I guess. That's part one, although I guess a person could go into a website and still catch a stream of this City of Bears part of the three-part series, right?
Yeah, it's the whole show is streaming on the PBS Nature website, so you can catch the whole thing on the web.
Yeah.
The entire episode.
And City of Bears then is, I want to get back to that because it is extremely interesting to me, and it's the one that's been on TV. But the one that will be coming up next is called The Road North. And in this case, you're kind of, it's a lot of geography, well, for one thing. And actually, the motorcycle is actually involved in this one. you're all the way from the Kenai Peninsula up to Dead Horse.
Correct. Yeah, exactly right. And it's funny because when the ads show Chris on this motorcycle, so everybody was asking with the first hour, where's the bike? Where's the bike? So in the second hour, you get the bike.
I'll bet.
And in fact, yeah, it was a pretty, it was a pretty long drive. So we started in Homer and drove all the way up to Dead Horse, Prudhoe Bay. And then it didn't really end there. From there, we hopped on to Kaktovik. But hour two pretty much takes place in that sort of massive stretch of highway.
So in this area, then, you're going to run across both brown and black bears, maybe not polar bears this time around. But you're, I'm thinking your route. There's one image in the book of Chris on his motorcycle on the Denali Highway, and I'm thinking, Denali Highway is very beautiful, but it's very interesting how the minute you get some distance past the gate in Denali National Park, your wildlife count tends to go up.
Right.
You guys probably did experience that because I see you have shots in Denali Park as well.
Yeah. Denali, we made several trips to Denali, and I've spent a lot of time there over the years filming. And to me, it's just a remarkable location. I mean, it's kind of cliche to say the Serengeti of North America, but it really is. It's just, it never ceases to amaze me how much wildlife you can see in such a vast area, especially considering that the bears are quite spread out there, yet every time you go through the park, you're bound to see some right off the road. So it's someplace that's always impressed me, I think, not just because of the spectacular vistas, but the wildlife that seems so abundant in that park.
We're speaking with Joe Pontecorvo. He's the filmmaker from Wildlife Media for the PBS Nature series Bears of the Last Frontier, which is now running on Sundays, and part two, The Road North, is coming up, and we're kind of looking at what happens in part two. And I think it's very interesting, Joe, that this is also where you kind of get more into the subject area of bears and people and how they regard one another, the issue of coexistence, which you probably have come across repeatedly. I mean, you know, a lot of these places where bears remain, you say, well, they're wild places. But then again, on the other hand, they're not without people. Alaska is a little bit less dense in the population sense. But in this particular episode, you're going through the more urbanized parts, right? I mean, even Anchorage itself.
Yes, and we actually spent a good deal of time in Anchorage. And I mean, that's, you know, the I think when people see a lot of these films like Planet Earth and so forth, it looks like a planet that's completely wild and barren of people. But, you know, we're really part of the equation, and that really needed, and that was part of our story. You know, Alaska isn't just this, you know, this vast untouched wilderness. It's inhabited. So we spent a good deal of time in Anchorage with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and Rick Sinnott and Jesse Coltrane were our primary folks. We sort of decided to tag along with them as they, you know, went out on various, you know, wildlife calls, everything from moose to black bears.
Yeah. Now, it's pretty clear, you know, from the way that Chris writes, and once again, Chris Morgan is actually the host, so he's the guy you see. You're the guy that we don't see, you and your crew, your wife and the others we don't see usually. Joe Pontecorvo, who we're talking with. But, you know, Chris is, he's always really pleased when you got your whole crew and you're hanging out in the spot and you get to the point where it's not like the bear doesn't know you're there, but the bear decides that it's kind of okay that you're there and just decides to go about its own business. And this takes a while, right? I mean, we're talking hours, really, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and in the case of, you know, in the case of black bears in Anchorage, let's say, and this is really the case of bears that we've encountered almost everywhere, is, you know, we want to let the bears know we're there, and we're not trying to spook them off, but we let them know we're there by talking to them. So you'll hear Chris in the documentary, he's talking to the bears all the time. And it takes time. You know, a lot of the times you're just sitting down, you're sitting still, you're being calm, and you're talking to them. In the case and we were actually in Bicentennial Park when we encountered a mom and two cubs, and that's in the heart of Anchorage in a way. And we followed them, you know, practically the whole day. And it took a little time. They were a little bit skittish. Perhaps they were skittish because there's also brown bears in the park. But after a while, you know, hearing our voices seemed to actually, you know, do the opposite of what we thought. We thought we should be quiet and silent and sneak around, but actually it seemed like the more they heard our voice, the more relaxed they felt with us because they knew we were there. We weren't trying to sneak up. When they heard a twig snap, they wouldn't think it was another bear, but just us. And they kind of ignored us for the most part.
But they know you're there.
They know we're there, yeah. And, I mean, I think that's critical, even with the brown bears that we filmed, not just in Katmai, but in the Western Arctic. And these are barren ground grizzlies that have, you know, a much more fierce reputation. Yet, when given the opportunity, and when we let them know we were there, they just pretty much went about their business. I mean, they were preoccupied with a run, salmon run. So, they had things to do. But really talking to them seemed to be, I don't know whether it was calming us down or calming the bears down, but it seemed to work.
You know, I'm know a lot of the bear people. I've gotten to know them in my line of work, but also just I personally kind of enjoy bear viewing and being around bears and so forth. And it's my observation that as time goes on, the bear biologists, and I'm thinking particularly of Larry Allmiller in this, become bear-like. They learn, and it seems to be it take a long period of time to get some feel for what is how the bear is actually viewing the world, what their notion of the world is. And, you know, that they orient by smell is one of the things you can learn fairly quickly. But there's other things, the more subtle things that I think that take a while for you to realize about the way that they're going about their business. And I'm wondering if you feel that you and Chris are becoming more bear-like as you work on this project.
Over this journey, I definitely felt we were becoming more bear-like, because you start to see, if you watch them long enough, you start to see the world through their eyes, through their perspective. And, you know, during mating season, you could pretty much predict what was going to happen. You would see a big male, and he would be smelling walking along a trail, smelling the tracks of a female. And you knew it was on his mind, and you knew he was going to track her down. And I think the really interesting thing is we would end up doing the same thing just to find them. You know, we would be, you know, walking along trails. We'd be smelling, here's where they sprayed urine here and there, and this is a tree they rubbed against. And, you know, you start to think like a bear because you're filming them. And over time, you start to see the whole ecosystem, their whole world through their perspective. And it's you know, the longer you're out there, the more you do that. And I think it's partly what the film is about, is really about interpreting not seeing bears as a whole, but seeing them as individuals, because they're all different. They're different as you and me, as any people you might meet. So I think that's the interesting thing about them, you know, that they're definitely all individuals. You can't, which is also, I think, why you can't have a blanket approach to bears either. You can't imagine that they're all going to be friendly and accommodating, nor can you think they're all going to be ferocious. You have to get to know them.
Well, I guess this is the point where we bring up Timothy Treadwell. I mean, he gave names to the bears, and of course he filmed himself in close proximity to the bears in Katmai, and he mythologized himself, and eventually it's a bear with a personality that he couldn't deal with, ended his life and that of his girlfriend. And now whenever we have brought this up on Talk of Alaska, it always provokes a whole lot of calls, and the calls tend to be very emotional, and they tend to go into the scornful area of what did this idiot think he was doing and on like that. But I'm wondering what kind of reaction, I mean, you just ran part one. Someone was shot in the same places where Treadwell was. There must have been some feedback coming back from the viewers at this point that reflect back to the Timothy Treadwell situation.
Yeah, and I think we knew from the beginning we went there that we were going to get some Treadwell comments. And I think, you know, one of the big differences, you know, how does Chris separate himself from Treadwell? And I think one of the main things is that, you know, he's a bear, you know, he's an ecologist, and he's been studying bears his whole life, and he teaches bear safety. So, you know, one of the things that happens when you're in bear country for a long time, especially camping among them, is I think you can get complacent. You know, Treadwell was there longer than we were, and probably longer than most people. But, you know, I honestly think he got complacent. You know, we used electric fences. We had bear-proof containers away from our. We carried pepper spray. We carried flares. You know, we never approached the bear. There's footage of Treadwell literally walking up and putting his hand out to bears, and that's something we never did. And I think it's easy after spending time amongst bears to start getting almost relaxed about it and feeling, you know, but you can't be that way. And for me, I always felt there was a constant source of slight tension when you have that many big bears around you, because you had to be looking over your shoulders the whole time. You know, I'm looking through the lens and Chris is looking behind me. And I think it's important that you stay alert and aware of what's happening in your surroundings, that you're reading the bears, just so you know what's going on. They're, like I said, they're all individuals. And the bear that ended Timothy Treadwell's life and his girlfriend was a bear he didn't know, a bear he had encountered before and just had a bad temperament. And I think that's what you have to be aware of. There's grouchy bears too, just like grouchy people.
Boy, yeah. Now that I think about it, I've run across a few of them. people that is. I'm sitting here, and this will strike you as odd, being how it's a radio show and you're on the telephone. But we're actually on television, and I'm going to hold up the if you take the dust jacket off the book, Bears of the Last Frontier, which is Chris Morgan's book that's tied in with this series. You have this fabulous photo of a male on the Alaska Peninsula. I think you probably know the photo I'm talking about. And maybe you could, I'm holding it up now for the camera, and maybe you could talk about what exactly is on this bear's mind.
Oh, that's funny you used to say that. I just took the cover off and looked at it as you talked. This is a male pursuing a female, actually, probably. It looks like it's during mating season. And that is a look of a bear who's doing just that, hot on the trail.
Are you happy with the results? He's kind of smiling. It almost looks like it's photoshopped.
Some of them look that way. You know, it's really funny because the really unusual thing about this location is that you're able to identify the same bears over and over again. And, you know, there's guides Brad Joseph who go there every single year without fail. You know, he lives in Homer, and every year he's there on the Alaska Peninsula. And, he's gotten to know them so well that he can tell you, you know, who's so-and-so's, you know, son and brother and all these kinds of things. And he's really traced them back pretty far. So, you know, it's like a community. It's a community of bears out there, and that's really unusual for an animal we consider to be solitary.
Yeah. Now you in this second part of the series, Bears of the Last Frontier, which includes a road trip on the Dalton Highway, there's not all that many bears up there, as I recall.
No.
My trip, I think I saw like maybe three, and one of them was in pretty far up the Dietrich River, I think. Tell me how that part of the trip worked out.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of the story was to make this journey all the way up through all kinds of bear habitat. And, yeah, it's pretty sparse, and during that time of year, it was hunting season as well. But
hunting season, and hunters definitely use that road.
Yeah, and it was a busy, busy road. So it was pretty sparse bear-wise. There was still a lot of caribou around. But, I mean, that's part of what the story was about, how this habitat, how we go from this very, very lush, rich, dense population in Katmai to a very sparse population the further north you go. And, I don't know if it would be fair to compare the stretch along right off the Dalton Highway necessarily as to other bear populations in the Arctic. Necessarily, because there's a road through there, and so a lot of times bears try to avoid people, and so you probably won't see a lot of them off the road necessarily, unless perhaps they're on the tail of a muskox or something like that.
Yeah,
muskoxen were out there, and I know bears prey on them. It's something we didn't get to see, unfortunately, but we would have loved to seen that.
We're talking with Joe Pontecorvo. He is the main, I guess, cinematographer and also writer for the Bears of the Last Frontier series, which is running on public television now as part of the Nature series. Chris Morgan is the host of that and also part of the crew. Chris is more the bear expert, and Joe's more the film expert. And Joe, I really appreciate you making yourself available. I know that Chris had to be on Letterman tonight, so there may be some people listening here that'll be seeing him on Letterman and how that works out. But this, how's the feedback going so far for this series?
You know, so far we've had a lot of really positive feedback about the show, which is really great. I think that I'm always curious. It's very difficult when you're a filmmaker. By the time you're done with the film, you're kind of tired of it already. You've seen it 1,000 times. So to see people comment, seeing it for the first time fresh, it's really refreshing that people really responded positively to it. All the things that we were hoping would be interesting aspects people found, which includes really teasing apart the individual personalities and talking, in hour one, we were talking about the entire kind of season of the bear, from mating season to salmon season. And so people seem to really love the show and really get absorbed in it. And Chris is, you know, wonderful on camera. He's just completely natural. And I think that's one of the things we're going, you know, we really were trying to attempt. We didn't want a cheesy, you know, we didn't want a host-driven show that was, we wanted something very natural where, you know, we just presented Chris as he would be if you were just alone, if he was just hanging out with bears, what he would do and the things he would do. So we didn't, weren't trying to contrive, you know, create situations that were not real.
Yeah, and then you also involve your pilot and your guides and all like that too. So that's good.
Yeah, I mean everybody that, you know, is part of the show kind of ends up in one way or another in the show. We were operated as a pretty small crew. When we were in Katmai, for the most part, it was the three of us. It was, you know, Nim, my wife, who did the sound, Chris and myself, and sometimes just Chris and I, we would go off and hike off. Now, we didn't leave her alone with the bear. She did have an electric fence, and she was in there. But we would often go off and explore. So some of the times it was just us, and some of the times it was Nim and I. Then we also had actually spent the summer in Anchorage, Dean Cannon, our associate producer, and he was on the trail of any black bear calls that went out. And so he was there all summer long, just standing by, waiting for a call, listening to the scanner.
We have we got a couple of email responses here, and one guy couldn't get him on the phone, but it's Joseph from Petersburg, and you probably are quite ready to take this one on, because the nature of your organization, Wildlife Media, as a nonprofit and looking to habitat and drawing the link between the top predator, the bear, and the wildness of the habitat and the health of the habitat. I would reckon that you might take a bit of a dim view of some of the predator control practices that you must know about in Alaska. In terms of bears, it's thought now to be the mission by the Fish and Game Department that they want to enhance, maximize the meat species, and that is resulting in predator control. Particularly, I guess the latest one is bear snaring, and that's what Joseph wanted to ask. He wanted your opinion on that.
Well, I'll be honest, you know, I just signed a petition against it.
Yeah.
Against bear snaring. I mean, I know that would be, you know, met with some, I'm sure that a lot of people would take offense to that. You know, they believe that their predator control needs to happen. And I can see a case for it in many cases. I'm just opposed to it personally. And I think, you know, I think in the lower 48, we've had all kinds of predator control, and to me, the results of a balanced ecosystem always work better than an imbalanced one. You know, we're trying to constantly control, whether it's wolves or bears, to, you know, keep what we're hoping is our prey count up. And it never works out quite the way we think. But on the other hand, how do you live with large predators? Can we live with large predators? You know, their mission is to go find food, and they eat meat as well as everything else. So it's always a really delicate balance, and that's why it's so controversial, whether you're talking about Montana or Wyoming or Alaska.
Have you guys dealt with the Rocky Mountain bears?
You know, I've filmed quite a bit in Yellowstone and in the surrounding areas, but not nearly as much as Chris has. Chris has spent more time out there than I.
Yeah, because a lot of Alaskans, they look at the wolf repopulation down there now, and they say, what are these idiots thinking?
Well, you know, we're talking about doing the same thing here in Washington, or at least we'd like to. And so I'm sure that everyone's thinking, why would you want to do that? But, again, it really comes down to a healthy ecosystem. I think, you know, if Yellowstone has proven anything, it's really shown how significant changes in the environment are, the things that take place, grasses that return, bird species that return, and it really has to do with putting that ecosystem back together in a whole. We really didn't know when we came into this country what we were doing when we started to extract species. We viewed them as predators, competing or injuring, you know, taking our cattle or competing with our food for food supply. and we began to eliminate them. And they turned out to be critical pieces of a very complex ecological puzzle. And when you start pulling those pieces out, you know, the system does unravel. We don't see it that way because we spend a ton of money just maintaining this balance that is actually a balance naturally maintained by nature. So even salmon in the Northwest, for example, we spend an extraordinary amount of money, you know, on salmon recovery after we've kind of cleaned them out, and also on just, you know, building these complicated fish ladders or systems for, you know, bussing them around dams and all these kinds of things. All these things are what happens when we start, you know, tipping the scales in a system and I think that and managing a system. So managing wildlife is very complicated, and it's a very difficult thing to do because in the end we're trying to figure out some way of replicating what nature had already done with these top predators. I know that's a very controversial opinion, but
yeah, but I mean, really, you can go way more than 50 years ago now that Adolf Murie did his work out there in Denali National Park and came up with really the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a new concept yeah. by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a hard thing to put into practice when you're talking about a large population of people. When someone turns around and says, "Well, what about my kids?" Yeah. You know, that's when it comes down to it. Or, you know, well, the wolves are killing all of the caribou, or whatever it might be.
Right.
It's you know, you can argue, you can turn around and you can say, well, you know, if everything was balanced, the caribou herds and the wolf packs would balance themselves out. They've continued to do it for thousands of years, and herds weren't wiped out. There was more. Let me not say more caribou, because I know that's a controversial thing saying that, but there were more different herds of caribous in different locations around Alaska. You know, at that time. And so, you know, you can hear a variety of opinions. You know, that's one thing driving up the Hall Road that we really learned. Every stop you took, whether it was Coldfoot or Wiseman or all the way up to Dead Horse, you got a different opinion about wolves, caribou, bears, from all different perspectives, those who are living subsistence lives to those who are game hunters.
Well, I bet you did hear it all. Well, I need to take a break here. We're talking with Joe Pontecorvo of Wildlife Media. He's the cinematographer for Bears of the Last Frontier, now running on PBS on Sunday nights as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Bears of the Last Frontier, Chris Morgan goes around on a motorcycle going all over the world, actually, for the motion picture that will be coming out, looking for bears and the wild country they come from. And, of course, a lot of that is in Alaska. And a three-part series for PBS has been put together, Bears of the Last Frontier. We're talking to the cinematographer, Joe Pontecorvo of Wildlife Media here. And our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, you can call 550-8422. Emails talk@aprn.org. I know I hadn't been giving out the phone numbers, and it's hard to get phone calls if you don't give out the phone number. But I'm sure people have stuff they want to talk to you about by now, Joe. And we'll start with Nicole, who responds by email. Nicole in AK. Bears are wild animals, she said. We should not be walking in the woods looking for bears to talk to. And you did describe that's what Chris tends to do, is always talk to these bears. Really? What are you trying to teach people? Says Nicole.
Well, that's a good point. Well, I think, you know, you have to remember there's a lot of different locations we were filming at. So when we were in you know, Katmai National Park, it's an unusual place where bears tolerate people. So we would never approach them. We would just get in the area where bears were and let them do their thing. But there, they ignore you. So no, you're right. We absolutely do not want people to walk up and approach bears necessarily. When we were in Bicentennial Park, in the upcoming episode that you'll see, there we were keeping a very safe distance from the bear. And what we would do is we would just sit down and let the bear do her thing. And we wouldn't necessarily track it the whole time through the forest and, you know, harassing the bear. It is a delicate line that you walk when you have a host that you want in the camera and you want to get a bear in the frame. So we were always very conscious to go seek out those situations where bears would accept us and not seek out the ones where they wouldn't, and never to follow a bear in such a way as to be harassing it or to give people an idea that we were actually pursuing these animals. So we chose locations where these encounters could unfold naturally without altering the bear's behavior or without putting ourselves in harm's way necessarily. You know, I think around any large carnivore, you're potentially in harm's way. So I guess really it's just operating with caution. But we would never encourage anyone to go around, you know, actively pursuing and following bears. But as a wildlife photographer, you, and as a filmmaker, your goal is to capture these animals on film. So you seek them out, but you seek them out from a safe distance.
Yeah, and I think Nicole probably knows it's Bear Country 101 that you make noise because the bear is not real, doesn't trust its eyes as much as it trusts its nose and its ears, and you really want to be, you want the bear to know you're there. You don't want to surprise, the last thing you want to do is surprise the damn bear.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good point. In fact, a lot of the bear maulings come from bears reacting because they're surprised.
Yeah.
You know, a bicycler comes around a corner on Rover's Run's trail and surprises a bear, and the bear gets scared. The bear is acting out of self-defense. So, yeah, you're right. Talking to the bear was really just a way to let the bear know we were there. I mean, we would go, hey, bear, walking through the woods just as you always should. If we end up seeing that bear and we're still talking to it and the bear doesn't take off, then it's an opportunity to film. If the bear takes off, well, then you miss that opportunity.
Well, Joseph in Petersburg called us back, so we have him on the line. Joseph, you still got more for Joe Pontecorvo?
Yeah, I do. In your dealings with the bears, I one of the things I pick up with you haven't really said outright is it seems like you treat these animals with respect, and you respect their habitat and their habits, and go out of your way not to disturb them while you're photographing them. But when you were discussing short briefly the predator control issue, currently right now, state of Alaska Board of Game has a predator control for black bear and brown bears on the west side of Cook Inlet, which is on the across from Anchorage there. It's known as Game Unit 16B. This is a baited bucket trap snaring program where they bait these buckets with meat, and then when the bear sticks his paws in the buckets, he's snared and confined. There's very little data. There's no peer review. It's unscientific. In 2009, 81 black bears were snared, but there's no data on size, age, weight, or sex. There's no data for 2010 that's available. The Department of Fish and Game has kind of taken a radical turn to the far right when it comes to predator control in Alaska. And now two of Alaska's iconic bear species, black and both brown bears now, or there's probably some sitting on snares right now waiting to be dispatched. It's unfortunate that this issue really hasn't come before the public in any way. You might see a paragraph in the newspaper, you know, on the third or fifth page, and I don't think a lot of people are aware of it or understand it. With all your insight into bear behavior, I wanted to ask if this type of treatment to these animals, which seems cruel, torturous, and unusual to me, I can't barely bear the fact that we're actually embarking on this type of predator control with all this unnecessary suffering. If you want to dispatch these creatures, then fine. But to leave them hanging there for days while they chew their paws off trying to get away is absolutely the opposite of everything you're talking about. And I think people's vision of wildlife in Alaska and how we treat it. So I think it's kind of an explosive issue that's very little known or heard about. And I was wondering what you could do with as much worldwide global interest in bears that you have to help spread this issue and let people know what's actually taking place up here under the guise of boosting moose production for sport hunters to fly in from the cities.
Wow, that's a great comment, and actually I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I think that's the role of filmmakers, and not just the role of filmmakers outside of Alaska, but also filmmakers in Alaska. And I had, I worked with a lot of people contributed to the film, and now that we've made those connections, we've been talking about things like this, about how do we bring these issues, how do we make people aware of them, especially things that are happening in your own backyard. And I think that's something that I'm actually would like to work with local Alaskan filmmakers on, to bring these issues to light. And, we've already been in discussions about it. So this is some ongoing thing that we're trying to explore. How can we do this? What can we do?
Well, they have my number at the office, and there's a whole bunch of old-time fish and game biologists and fish and game employees and people in the state that are just in absolute despair. A number of these board game members were just recently reappointed for 3-year terms. And, I think most Alaskans are fair-minded and want to do the right thing. Somehow these guys got off on the wrong tangent and the wrong track. There's a lot of people out there, like you say, filmmakers and whatnot, that'd be interested in discussing this issue with you, because when it comes to the state and the governor, we've just run into a brick wall.
Okay, Joseph, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will pass on your contact information to Joe, okay?
Good luck on your work, sir. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. And of course, a fishing game were here, I'm sure that they would be saying, look, the problem on the other side of Cook Inlet is a depressed population of the meat species, and this is moving forward with our predator control. They're not here to say that, but I think that would be pretty much what it would be. Let's go to line 3 now. And is Deb, is it? Bill from Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, I just wanted to compliment Chris and Joe on I'm a musician, and sometimes the musician puts themselves in front of the song. These guys reported the bears very, very, what I call efficiently and objectively, and that's pretty hard to do, I think. But this thing needs to go to the White House, and I live here in Anchorage. I mean, you show the president. I live here in Anchorage. I learned a lot about bears that I didn't know about in my town. I've been here since, like, 71, and you never heard of a bear sighting in the 70s, very rarely. You hear a lot about more of it now. But I just wanted to say you guys did a really good job, and take it as far as you can go, and that's all I got right now. Thank you.
Joe?
All right. Thank you very much. That's great. Thanks so much.
Okay. Well, move on to Scott in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Scott.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Joe, I saw the first episode on Sunday. It's fantastic.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Absolutely fantastic. I had a couple questions for you. First, the last two callers, I'd like to remind them that less bears equals more moose. Bears, particularly black bears, they kill moose calves. If you kill all the moose calves, you have no moose. Now, I'm not going to go into a long dissertation like the caller before me, but it's pretty simple, pretty straightforward stuff. Fish and Game's trying to equalize, trying to work two species so that everybody can be happy. And
yeah, Scott,
again,
Scott, maybe
no
I could.
Moose, there's no bears.
Yeah, Scott, Scott, I maybe could just add just a little bit. I think, as I understand it, if you take a natural predator prey cycle, what tends to happen is it takes a longer period of time, and a lot of the management techniques of the of fish and game, as I understand it, are to try and shorten that cycle when the prey population is down, to not have that be so long. Isn't that pretty much what we're talking about?
They're working on a balance is what they're trying to do. I can certainly come up with plenty of criticism of fish and game. Believe me, I've been Alaskan since I was a small child and done a lot of hunting and fishing up here. There's plenty of criticism of fish and game to go around. The question I had, though, is there was a part of the show on Sunday. First, again, I loved it. But there was a part where a sow with two cubs meandered on right up to you guys when you were filming them. And I mean, literally, I'm watching this, and I'm an old Alaskan. You know, I'm pretty sarcastic when it comes to, you know, Hollywood or anybody else coming up and filming my bears, right? And I'm watching this, and I'm watching this bear grazing right up to you guys. And, of course, I know you're the guy filming, and you're behind the camera. The guy in front of the camera is watching this, and he's talking to these two bear cubs. And he actually says to him, "Hey, now, don't get too close. You're going to get me in trouble." And I kind of in the background, I swear I can hear the cameraman making like kind of a little funny noise or something, kind of shoo him away. Did I misread that, or is that the way that went down?
No, I wasn't. I was trying to actually be really quiet. But what I was doing is asking Chris to see if everything was if you're okay. And he says, and he was just saying, chill down, chill out. You know, he just wanted to make sure everybody was chilled out. It's really important not to, like, at that stage, not to do anything that would surprise the bear. So we didn't want to do that.
I'll tell you what, it was impressive. And it was pretty spooky. But you guys did a great job. I mean, the filming was beautiful. Everything was just, it was a great show. Thanks again.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Scott. We're talking to cinematographer Joe Pontecorvo of Wildlife Media as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
It's a three-part series on PBS, and the second part is about to run. It's called Bears of the Last Frontier. We're talking to the cinematographer and writer, Joe Pontecorvo, of Wildlife Media. Now, this is a nonprofit that very definitely is into wildlife habitat conservation and is dwelling on bears because bears and wildness seem to go together. Joe, I have to ask you, in light of Scott's question, there must have been times when you actually did have to haze off a cub or a bear. There just had to be.
You know, Chris always, you know, sort of prides himself on not having to have ever had to use a flare or pepper spray in the field. But I do have one story where we actually had to flare a bear. And it was interesting. It was my wife and I. Chris had actually already left, and we had stayed behind to film wolves. And we found a wolf den, and we were hiking about a couple miles every day through this meadow, and it was like running the gauntlet of bears. It was towards the end of mating season, and you know, it was the sedges were drying up, and the bears seemed pretty bored, and they just really got curious about us. Now, it's true in this part of Alaska, you know, in the Alaska Peninsula, the more people you travel with together as a group, the bears kind of ignore you, and the smaller the group is, the more curious they'll get about you. So we would pass through this field, you know, every morning and every evening, and it was on our way back, and it was starting to get dark, so you can imagine how late it was because it was summer, so it was probably about 1 o'clock. We'd stayed later than we should have. We were hiking back through the meadow. We had our headlamps on, and, you know, we had already dealt with these bears. Every time we went through, they would come up to us, start to approach us, and we'd sort of have to talk them down. And talking them down basically just means, "Hey, bear, let us pass." You know, we'd be talking to them, and then we'd wait until they got bored with us and found out we weren't so interesting, and they'd wander off. Well, this particular time, on our way back, it was dark, had our headlamps on just so we could see a little bit better. It was starting to get dusky. And this one bear came up and started following us. And, you know, he wasn't, he was just curious about us. You know, he was a male, an older, not a juvenile, but a young bear, but a big bear. And, you know, he started checking us out, and we stopped, and we would talk to him a bit and carry on. But it got to the point where he was in that stalking mode, which you can start to recognize when a bear starts stalking you. Now, he wasn't stalking us as prey. Again, I think it was just sheer curiosity. Maybe it was the headlamps that attracted him. We really don't know at this point, you know. But we ended up having to pull a flare. And we didn't pepper spray. We pulled this flare out. It lit up the whole night sky, and he took off. And that was the end of that. But it was a really tense moment. My wife was actually less nervous than me, I think, to be honest with you.
Wow. Yeah, thanks for sharing that tale. I think one thing that anybody who watches bears for any length of time gets is that, you know, this animal's a whole lot more powerful than I am in many, many different ways.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, the smaller the group, we're not big people, you know, I think it was just one of those things where I think it got to a point we were exhausted. We had been, you know, walking through this meadow and trying to talk these bears down every time we passed through this sort of what we call gauntlet of bears. It was like, you know, half a dozen bears in this meadow. And every time there was like two or three of them that were just always on us, you know, curious. And so at some point it just becomes too unsafe and you need to do something about it.
Yeah, and there are, I bear biologists say that it's that one stage of just past cubness where bears were probably the most dangerous and most experimental, and they will, those tend to be the ones that get interested in people.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we found was that, you know, those juveniles, you know, they're just like any teenagers, you know, they're reckless sometimes, and they're always getting into trouble and pushing the limits. They just like to push the limits, and that this bear was definitely, you know, seeing if he could get a rise out of us, you know, pushing the limits. And I think that's, you know, that's what makes bears so interesting, you know, because they are so smart. You know, they're really clever animals, and they figure things out, and they they test you, and these bears were definitely doing that.
Well, I often think, and it's been told to me from tradition, that humans for a very, very long time, many, many generations, many pre-literate generations, maybe even pre-language generations, would learn to follow bears around because the diets are similar. And because they could actually, you're a hunter, you're a gatherer, and what a bear can eat, you can eat. And so you want to follow the bear around and find out what it eats so you can eat it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it's got to go back many, many generations. I think maybe this accounts to some degree for the emotional nature of what most people feel in response to bears. I mean, whether they freak you out or whether they, you know, make you feel with brotherly, bearly love. You know, there's emotion there. I mean, it's very hard to talk about, but I don't think anyone who has closely viewed bears doesn't have that emotional connection.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really feel like, I think that's probably what makes bear management so complex, or what makes predator management so complex, is that, you know, we both eat a lot of the same things and are, you know, the same kind of food sources, and we're both very smart predators. You know, bears are really clever. They figure things out. They'll figure out a way to get into your garbage can. They'll figure out a way to, you know, they learn fast, and they don't often repeat the same mistakes twice. You find a bear trying to break into a bear-proof container, and they'll figure out a way to do it, or bear-resistant container, you know, maybe not the first time, but you bring it back. You know, Chris used to do these demonstrations at Woodland Park Zoo where he'd test different bear-proof containers on the bears there. And, you know, the first time they experienced it would take them hours and hours, and they couldn't quite get the seal open. And then the next time, they wouldn't try anything they did last time. They try something completely new, and within 2 hours, they break into it.
Oh, but boy.
A year later, they remembered, and they figured it out. So
oh, boy.
Like, I remember this container.
So of the bears of the world, have you managed to actually get all of them on film?
No, no. You know, we really would like to have captured many more locations than we did. We wanted to do sloth bears in India and so forth. But, you know, it was just a matter of raising that kind of money to do it. And so we selected, you know, a handful of bear species, and, you know, and particularly the sun bear, which is a really unusual bear. For people who are familiar with brown bears and black bears, a sun bear is so arboreal, they remind you of a primate. I mean, they can hang and swing from trees, and it's the most arboreal of the bear species. And then to go to the spectacle bear, which live in a, you know, this area that we were filming in Peru, wasn't a jungle. It was actually kind of this, you know, high desert. Like, it looks almost like Southern California. But these sheer rock faces, they're very long. They have elongated bodies with long hind legs and long front legs. And they stretch themselves out on these cliff sides and climb up the sides of these cliffs. Just unbelievable thing to see.
Fascinating. We got time for one more call. Let's go to Joanne in Unalakleet. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Joe Pontecorvo.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
I live in very western Alaska next to the on the Bering Sea. And when I was young, my parents and my grandparents very rarely talked about bear because we didn't have any bear on the coast a couple generations ago. And now many of the cabin owners up on the Unalakleet and the other rivers and tributaries here on the coast are having problems with bear. For example, our house that we live in is 2 miles out of Unalakleet, and last summer or the other summer, my husband had to kill a bear that was outside the porch. And then we have a cabin that's about 8 miles on the coastline south of Shaktulik up on the hill at the foothills. And again, my husband had to kill a bear that was destroying property. So we do have a problem with bear on the coastline here in western Alaska. And I think this problem needs to be addressed.
Joanne, I want to thank you for your call, and I'm not going to have time for a response from Joe Pontecorvo, but I really think that this is something needs to be explored some more, so I'm really very glad that you called. So I want to thank you very much from Unalakleet. Okay, Joe, part three of Bears of the Last Frontier, what's it going to be?
Okay, part three of Bears of the Last Frontier takes place all above the Arctic Circle, so we explore regions like Kaktovik and Barrow, and then we also go down into the Western Arctic or the petroleum reserve and follow the Western Arctic herd of caribou and end up in Gates of the Arctic with a family of grizzlies there.
Okay, and caribou also. Thank you so much.
In that one.
Thank you so much for being with us. That was the cinematographer, Joe Pontecorvo of Bears of the Last Frontier. Next week on Talk of Alaska, we've got first responders. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.